I remember walking across the rope, you know, walking on day five, we're needing 100 runs to win. And Andrew Simons, I mean, he's a big, stocky character, right? He meets me close to the rope that you have to walk across. And he just looks at me, doesn't say a single word, and just walks with me, staring at me. And I'm like this young kid, like staring at him, like, what do I do here? I was so intimidating.
Welcome to The Biggest Man in Cricket with your host, David Brook.
So you landed yesterday.
I landed yesterday evening, yeah.
Nice one. How was that? How was that actual event? I mean, from a broadcasting point of view, it actually was. It looked pretty lekker.
The WCL.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was cool. Like, you know, we. It was interesting. Like thinking back to last year, we were the walking wounded there. We obviously had a average older crew.
Yeah.
And obviously, a lot of guys wouldn't have played a lot of cricket in recent years. So credit has to go to the owners around their strategic thinking with Alan Donald, who was the coach. All right, how do we manage this better where we're not too concerned about injuries? So I was actually a replacement player, believe it or not. So I wasn't actually in the initial 15. I don't know who pulled out.
Maybe Malaysia, Dane Villas, because he got the...
Yes, that's right. So he was one of them. So I might have come in for him. Anyway, and yeah, so we had a kind of average lesser age crew that a lot of guys would have played cricket in the recent probably 2 years or so.
Yeah.
It was crazy thinking that I'm one of the older guys there. And yeah, it was really cool, man. Just to like the bands in the change room. We didn't really practice much. We had one training session. We had one team meeting. And the first thing that Alan Donald said in the team meeting, guys, this is the one and only team meeting we're going to have. So essentially, guys looked at it as like a glorified golf trip with a little bit of cricket.
Yeah.
And yeah, guys had a lot of fun. We actually, we went to a live golf event as well.
I saw that on socials. Yeah. Oh, that's
that awesome. Was out of this world, man.
That was timed beautifully. Yeah.
Oh, lovely.
Wow.
The only down part to it, I guess the guys were a little bit disappointed. We had to play the next day.
So
the vibe was going. So it was actually the Saturday as well. And so how they do it on a Saturday, they have a concert. I can't remember who was performing.
Wow.
And it was thousands of people.
Yeah.
At the actual golf course.
Yeah.
And it was crazy, man. And obviously we were looked after quite nicely by the South African team.
Yeah.
Met the players. Yeah, we had a draw it.
This is a cricket podcast, but I mean, it's relevant to sport in South Africa. The Stinger Golf, you know, the Live Golf is coming to South Africa. That has to be
density.
A great thing to have as a discussion point when you saw these guys. I mean, you played probably with some of those guys. You know them being in the South African sports space.
Yeah. I mean, Gaten McKenzie was there as well at the event. And
it looked like Gaten to be at those kind of events. I mean, he's normally quite timid and...
When I saw him, he's like, I wear Mazakin. going back to his roots. But, you know, yeah, I think this is an exciting sporting occasion for South Africa.
Yeah.
And obviously the Stinger team won recently as well. So there's a lot of hype around, one, the team, but also the Live Golf event and what it brings. It's such a great element to it. You think about the entertainment factor.
Yeah.
I mean, this... I've actually not watched Live Golf before I actually went to the event.
That's cool. I like that, yeah.
Thanks, dude.
This is what we do when we're 40 plus.
Yeah,
we,
40 plus.
And you've been traveling, so we give you a bit of a vitamin shot. I'm still on the coffee.
Are you 40 plus?
I'm 40 plus. I'm heading towards 50.
Anyway, so what I loved about it, so there's certain holes where there's actually like a walkout song.
Oh, wow.
For every... golfer. So like I think they play in three balls and they announce your name.
Yeah.
And then you have a walkout song.
Yeah.
And the players are actually like vibing the song before they actually have to like line up and focus about their shot.
What would your walkout song be?
Mendoza.
That's
a great vibe.
Yeah.
So that was quite cool to see where, you know, there's a lot of noise and entertainment around the actual event. And the guys just crack on and get on with it.
It's actually amazing. I was watching it and just going back to the cricket context around this, people obviously are not necessarily putting two and two together, but 2026 will obviously be those kind of major events coming to South Africa, and then the 2027 Cricket World Cup
Correct.
is going to be in South Africa. So from a South Africa being on the world sporting stage, it's a pretty exciting time, right?
100%. And I think the context of South Africa winning the World Test Championship final as well, there's obviously a lot of hype around cricket now, which is great. I mean, I wouldn't call it a world championship per se, like us winning the WCL, but
Listen,
we'll take
we'll
it,
take
you
any
know?
final win.
You know, the thing I thought about with that victory, if we didn't win, people will be commenting about, oh, still chokers, blah, blah, blah.
100%.
So, hey, we'll take the win then.
Absolutely. There was nothing better because a lot of you guys were in that team have faced enough heartbreak over the years that
We didn't get past the
take that
semi-final.
bloody trophy. I think if you won last year, it wouldn't have been like as
Fair enough.
special. But now, you know, it's like, let's just keep the winning rolling. We'll take anything. I mean,
100%. So it's been really cool over the last couple of months. And as you said, looking forward to 2026, Steyn City. I think it's March, the LIV Golf event, and then obviously 2027. There's some great sporting events to look forward to. And I'm certainly excited by the prospects of 2027, particularly the Cricket World Cup. There's no doubt going to be, let's call it added pressure per se,
Of course.
or expectation rather, not pressure. There'll be expectation now. But I think if we just look at who's at the helm at the moment, you know him well as well, Shukri Conrad. And I think he's suited for this right now, where we are
Definitely.
placed, and I think he's got a great feel for the youngsters coming in. He's obviously spent a lot of time coaching in that sort of era of the next generation, and guys respect him for what he's done in cricket. So he's nicely poised for, you know, bringing this team together. And I think we stand a really good chance to win a home World Cup. Why not?
It would be the pinnacle. I think everyone after that would drop the mic and say,
Exactly.
absolutely. You would have played under Shooks, right? Back in Province days, in Cobras days. How was he? You're obviously a young player coming through, or you were in, you know, one of the more experienced at the time. How was he as a coach then?
To date, probably one of the best coaches I've played under. One of the best people I know in the cricketing game. And I mean, to date now, we still have a great relationship. Obviously, I'm in the coaching world now as well, so the conversation is slightly different. But you know, I've always had huge amounts of respect for him and his wife Warda as well. Warda has played a pivotal part in my career as well. Back then, she was actually a life coach, believe it or not. And I spent quite a bit of time working with her, just on a personal level, which was great. But we've always had this amazing connection, myself and Shooks. And you know, you always felt like he was always overlooked over a long period of time, didn't particularly have the profile per se that some of the other coaches might have had. Did it the hard way, I guess you can
The
say,
old school
the
way.
old school way. And just developed as a coach under some really good people that he's worked with, and now has been seen as one of the more senior guys in the coaching space, and somebody that has a lot of confidence and understanding about the game and also coaching and how you relate to people. And for some reason, he got me, you know, as a player. You just knew how to get the best out of me. You knew when I needed a arm over the shoulder. You knew when I needed a kick up the butt. And you know, oftentimes he kicked me,
Literally.
literally. And you know, he wasn't shy to, if he needed to be left out of the team for whatever reason, just to, you know, keep the motivation there. He was always quick to have the hard conversation. Straight talker, you know, didn't beat around the bush in any way. And I think the guys are responding pretty well to that type and style of coaching right now.
It's almost like it was meant to be that he got this role now for this generation of players, where it wasn't the superstar players like you know, maybe that other coaches have had the ability, where it's like, we've got all these superstars, we just need to run the sessions kind of thing. He seems to be the perfect guy for this group of players. You just see, I always say that some of the best teams are when a youngster comes into that team, that they succeed straight away, because they don't need betting in. They're walking into a winning side with a winning mentality and a coach that allows them to be who they are.
I guess it's just different seasons that teams go through, right? You think back to when we were there. Yes, you talk about superstars. There were certainly superstars in our era, and they just, in many ways, probably just needed management, really, other than coaching.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that the coach at the time wasn't good enough. He was certainly good enough. Unfortunately, as players, we just couldn't get over the line. Mm. And, I mean, we could have a long debate as to why. You know, there are many, many influencing factors there. But as you said, I think with this generation of cricketers now, they seem to be certainly responding well to his style of coaching, and long may it continue. You know, he's taken over now on in terms of all formats, which is cool. So we've obviously pivoted on the strategy, and yeah, so far so good.
Was Shooks there at the Cobras before you made your international debut?
No, so I actually made my debut in 2004.
Yeah.
And he, if I remember correctly, joined in 2006.
Okay.
So it was actually prime for me because I made my debut for South Africa at age 20.
Yeah.
And then had a big dip.
You were dropped?
Yeah, I was dropped. And I basically played 5 games, then got left out for 3 years.
Mm.
So for me, I guess it was almost like trying to find the motivation again, because that was quite a depressive time in my career where I wasn't sure, like, where do I go from here? You achieve this pinnacle at such a young age. You're not mature in any way. And all of a sudden now you get left out. So what do I do? Now you kind of start believing certain things. You have doubts, fears, worries. Am I going to get back again? But I think it was prime for me looking back at it now. Got a taste of it. Realized that I was certainly well below the mark on all fronts when it comes to sustainability and consistency at that level. Got a taste. Got an opportunity to come back, rethink, recalibrate, and, you know, surround myself with the right people to know that, hey, these people are going to help me get back there. But more importantly, not only get back there, how do I stay there on a consistent level?
100%.
And this is where Shooks was really good as well.
He was there for you.
Yeah. And he very much took me under his wing around that. Some hard conversations were had. And, you know, within, what is it, a year and a half, I was back within the national team. And there were ebbs and flows from about 2007, 2008 till the end. You know, I sort of went on a consistent spree of, I think it was 12 years where I was in the national team. But it doesn't mean that I wasn't dropped at any point, you know. I guess I knew, or I had better ways of dealing with the disappointment and the frustration. But they certainly played a heck of a role in my career, yeah.
And you got back into the national team. And you got into your test debut. Ash got injured.
Yeah.
And that was the famous story of Ash being injured. And you obviously had played with Ash at Cobras. And firstly, how did that come about? How did it work? Did you get a phone call from the selector saying, was it before the tour, or had Ash been named in that side already?
So how it worked was 2008, we were touring Australia.
Yeah.
End of 2008, I was the backup batter. So Ashwell was on the tour. We had played a warm-up game. He only got injured the day before the first test.
Oh, wow.
So he got hit. I think Makai and Tini bounced him. He got hit on the thumb in training. I'll never forget it. I was actually catching with the mitt for Paul Harris. So he likes to bowl at markers before before a test match. And I was obviously 12th man, so I'm not really like front and center as part of the training session. Halfway through, I'm busy catching, and I see Mickey Arthur running across the field, and he's like, hey, Ashwell just got hit. You need to actually come into the nets and just prepare, as we don't know what it's going to be like. You know, just come and prepare. Anyway, like, obviously frantic, and like, oh, gosh, this actually might be happening. Anyway, got into practice. And did my thing and then went back to the hotel. At that point in time, nothing was confirmed. I remember it was a bit of a iffy sleep, actually, because you're not sure if you're in or not.
Yeah.
And I got a message from Ashwell the next morning, the morning of the first day of the first test, probably about 6:30. And he said to me, obviously, like at this point, just to give a context, I mean, Ashwell was a mentor for me, you know, just sort of a generation before me.
Yeah.
He was at Western Province. I had come in. He took me under his wing. We had played for Victoria Cricket Club, the same club. And he messaged me saying, hey, but look, it probably doesn't look good for me to play. So just want to wish you well if you get on the park.
That's amazing.
And then it was like, the heart rate went up.
This is real.
This is real. Mm. And still at that point, it wasn't confirmed.
Mm.
So what happened was in the change room before we went out for warm-ups, they still tried to inject him to see if they could numb his thumb and how it felt when he gripped the bat. Mm. And there were a whole lot of things going on. An hour before the start of play, Mickey came to me. Yeah. Now, remember, the toss happens an half an hour before, and I got told, confirmed, you in an hour before. Walking out to the mighty Australians,
wow.
And we've never won a test series there before.
Yeah.
And there you're walking out with the big dogs. My first innings got bounced out by Mitchell Johnson. And I remember, the second innings was obviously the famous one where 50 not out in that massive partnership with AB.
Yeah.
And I remember walking across the rope, you know, walking on day five, we're needing 100 runs to win. And Andrew Simons, I mean, he's a big, stocky character, right? He meets me close to the rope that you have to walk across. And he just looks at me, doesn't say a single word, and just walks with me, staring at me. And I'm like this young kid, like staring at him, like, what do I do here? It was so intimidating. Yeah. Anyway, but fortunately, obviously, myself and AB at that point would have played a lot of junior cricket together.
Mm.
So we knew each other well. And we put on that crazy partnership, which was fantastic, man.
And it got a little bit better the next test match as well. Take us through. I mean, you obviously now, you scored a half century in your first test match.
Yeah.
You now have announced yourself on the on the international stage. Now you go and you go three times bigger than that.
Sure.
How did that feel?
Well, again, context to this is, so after the first test, I mean, we great celebrations, you know, everybody's, you know, sending messages from South Africa and I still had this understanding there. Like, I didn't know the extent of Ashwell's injury.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, well, he's probably back in the next test match.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't really give it any thought until probably the day before the second test, where Mickey said, look, it's a fracture and he's unlikely to be fit to play the second test.
Mm.
And okay, again, it's real.
Mm.
But I guess what helped me in that time was I always felt and knew that he was ahead of me.
Yeah.
You know, so all I can do is really just lap up this opportunity and try and be and perform the best of my ability and we'll take it from there. You know, I always felt that he was going to come back in. He was in the prime of his career.
Is there less pressure to go in like that rather than you're naive in the starting lineup up front?
Yeah, maybe naively for myself, it probably helped me.
Mm.
And I would say that I felt less pressure based upon the fact that it happened so quickly.
Yeah.
I didn't have a lot of time to think about the process too much. And again, you know, walked out in, what is it? They batted first, if I remember. Yeah. So they batted first. 80,000 people day one, MCG. What an experience, man.
Yeah.
I remember I was standing backward point. Neil McKenzie was at Gully.
Yeah.
And the first over, I was trying to talk to him. We couldn't hear each other.
Yeah.
It was so loud. It was crazy. The Coliseum, that kind of feel. And it was just an unbelievable experience.
A long way from Victoria.
Well, it actually is Victoria.
That's the true. State. Yeah.
And I walked out to bat and we were in a little bit of trouble. So for some reason, you know, it just kind of worked out where it didn't feel like this immense amount of pressure because, you know, I was the youngster in the team and we were up against it and I just needed to play. Fortunately for us, Brett Lee got injured in that innings. So they were a bowler short and they generally back then went in with just three seamers and a spinner.
Yeah.
They didn't necessarily have the all-rounder as most teams have now.
Mm.
And so they only had two frontline seamers. So fortunately, myself and Dale then put on this cool partnership. And man, the real highlight of the story is we had this conversation, I think, post day three, if I'm not mistaken. And we were about, I don't know how many we were behind. But Mickey spoke in the team meeting and he said, we just got to try and get as close to 100 runs behind.
Mm.
And we ended up going, 180 ahead or whatever it was. And I remember when I got out eventually and 166 and walking off the field, getting handshakes from the Australians. I mean, these guys are legends of the game before I came to the team, the South African guys, Graham, Jacques, Bouch, and all these guys. And they made an arch in the walkway with their bats as a celebration of the performance that I put in. I was blown away for the appreciation of my teammates in that moment. Obviously, I'd spent a lot of time in the test side touring, being 12th man for probably about a year and a half without playing. And they had this huge amount of appreciation in that moment.
Wow.
One of the highlights of my career, man.
I mean, what do you start your career like that, right? The problem is that...
How do you maintain it?
How do you maintain it? I'm sure you've been asked this a number of times, but what goes through... I mean, you're a very level-headed guy. You're very kind of measured and you're a normal guy, which is a really good trait when it comes to these things. You've never got a big head.
Sure.
But everyone else is fawning over you. The country's going mad. You can feel the energy.
Mm.
And you come back to South Africa, and all of a sudden, nobody really knew who JP Duminy was before that. Now, all of a sudden, you're the darling of the country. How did that feel?
Well,
it's very hard not to get swept up in that. Yeah. In that.
I mean, I would say there were moments where you lap it up in some way, right? I mean, I was very fortunate to have good people around me that didn't allow me to get big-headed.
Yeah.
I guess the thing that stands out was coming back from Australia.
Mm.
Honestly, arriving at Oortambo International, it felt like we literally had won a World Cup.
Yeah.
There were thousands of people there to receive us. Can you believe it? And this was just winning a series against Australia in Australia.
They were the great Australians.
Yeah. And I remember there was a podium where... And a stage where, you know, everybody got called individually and the crowd went mad and the media was there. And I was like, wow, man, this is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And like you said, you know, obviously expectation ramps up.
Yeah.
And how do you maintain this level of performance? Unfortunately, I didn't. You know, I went through many, many highs and lows.
Mm.
And I'd never change anything. Because I think there's so many life lessons that I took out of the game that I can take forward, particularly if I look at how one can engage with the next generation and the younger players, because they would look to you for advice and how do you deal with this? How do you deal with that? And I think the ups and downs allows for myself to be able to speak into that, which is great. But I certainly never got it right all the time, you know? Having perspective that I think the thing that landed for me at some point in the back half of my career, and this was actually Shukri's words, cricket is not my life, it's a part of my life.
Love it.
And, you know, once I truly understood that, I think perspective sunk in. Because if you think about it, if cricket is your life, then every ebb and flow around that, you're dependent on that for who you are. And such a great question that we get to ask ourselves nowadays is, who are we as people?
Yeah.
And that's a difficult question to answer. Because often what people will do is they will say what they do.
Yeah.
But that's actually not who
you
are.
What do you do for a living?
Yeah. That's not actually who you are. That's what you do.
Yeah.
So I think when we are able to distinguish between that and have a clear understanding of, hey, who are you, JP? I'm a father. You know, I'm a brother. And. So... that is my identity. And it's such a critical piece in society today in understanding who we are as people. And what we do is only a part of it.
I'm the biggest man in cricket.
That's what you do.
That's what I do and who I am. I must ask you, because we had Dale obviously in a previous episode, and he was talking about how he hated batting because bowlers were, but that innings that he played, you know, in that particular test match, he wasn't so bad, eh? I mean, he stood his own.
No, he certainly did, man. And, you know, credit has to go to guys like Bouch. Bouch spent a lot of time with the tail-enders.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he was a straight shooter. He used to say, right, you guys are not getting any balls pitched up, so we're not going to practice that. Everything was short. And I remember Paul Harris was like a dartboard, man. You know, he was always our night watchman back then.
Yeah.
And he used to come into the change room with bruise after bruise. But he took it.
Yeah.
And, you know, they spent a lot of time in preparing that. And credit has to go to Dale as well, going through that cycle of, hey, this is what we're going to get, so we're going to prepare for it. And when the opportunity comes to score, we try and take it. So there were some great conversations in the middle with us, trying to recognize opportunities to pounce and to score. You know, there were times where the bowlers were tired, so Mike Hussey came onto the ball, right, here's an opportunity to score now. The spinner, right arm off spinner, that's a great matchup for him, take it down. So there's some nice tactical play as well, along with the bravery of what needed to be done. Yeah.
He liked a good arm guard as well.
And a little mattress.
Everything on the to protect him. It was a funny story that Dale shared with us. Obviously now you come back to South Africa, and kind of like, it was now the, you know, the IPL came calling, and Mumbai Indians came calling. You were part of that first wave of South African superstars that were the pioneers for IPL cricket, and really got recognized for your quality of play. But all of a sudden there was big money being thrown around for South African cricketers from a RAN point of view.
Yeah.
How did you feel that, I mean, you hadn't earned that kind of money ever before, even as a Proteas player, you get that kind of offer on the table. How does that feel? And does that come with it, with obvious added pressure?
Yes and yes. I mean, that was life-changing, really. I think back to, I remember we were out for dinner once, and you know, obviously it was public knowledge and was in the media of what had happened around IPL. And I just remembered like feeling like I noticed that a lot more people are looking at me. And you can actually feel that, you know, to a degree. And that brought about a different feeling, in the sense almost like, do I have to watch my back?
Yeah.
In a way. But the expectation now certainly rose in terms of how do you live up to that expectation of performance, firstly. One, if I think back to actually being in the first, my first IPL, which was the 2009 version, which was in South Africa. And we had just finished a South African series against Australia, and the IPL started the next day after the last ODI. So the last ODI was in Johannesburg. The next day in Cape Town was the first match, which was our opening. I flew that morning. I landed, went straight to the hotel where the Mumbai Indians would stay. And I actually didn't even make it to the team meeting. I walked straight onto the bus. And I remember like, oh my gosh, this was like so nerve-wracking. I walked in, Sachin Tendulkar, Zahir Khan, Jai Surya, and I'm a 24-year-old lighty. And I'm like, hello.
Toyota Hilux, which you normally go to domestic.
No. That was so intimidating. And I just like, Hi, and we're straight to the back of the bus, like, jeez, how crazy is this? And now obviously you the high price tag as well, and expectation. I mean, the game, we won the game. I didn't particularly perform well, but the season was okay. The team didn't do well, but I thought I did relatively okay, with highest run scorer for our team, and so that went relatively well. But what was so cool was just getting to be in the same change room with these legends, man. Such pure gentlemen of the game, played the game hard, but always willing to have a conversation about cricket. So that was really cool. Coming back to the expectation of, you know, the price tag, 100%. But again, from a family perspective and friends' perspective, you know, they kept me level-headed. Still called me out on my shit, hated me. But it was certainly a game changer.
Jermaine, I mean, he's part of your life. You get a lot of money like that. You know, a lot of youngsters will blow that kind of thing. You know, you're in that kind of mentor role to many youngsters now through your foundation, and we'll get into that. But how important was it for you to set up your life at that point to have guys, agents, you know, mentors or family members that... not after your money, they're there to help you.
Again, it comes back to this idea of surrounding ourselves with the right people. And you know, I certainly didn't get this right all the time. You know, you make some mistakes, you put it down to school fees. But yes, I was very, very fortunate to be able to set certain things up and make sure that, you know, I was certainly coming from some humble beginnings. So the natural progression would be to look after certain family members, make sure that they are taken care of. We still try and do that today. And that's sort of an appreciation for, you know, the sacrifices that your parents made for you, grandparents made for you. I mean, my grandparents never missed a game in junior cricket. Mm. You know, that blue Toyota Corolla 1.6 was always there next to the field.
Love it.
You know, so you never ever want to lose track of those kind of things. Mm. But yeah, I mean, speak about Jermaine, best mate since grade 8. Mm. Now my manager for the last probably 7-8 years. Yeah, and these people are just really rooted in making sure they take care of you, yeah.
Was the foundation, the JP21 Foundation, yeah. for those who don't know, was that always part of your plan, or when did that idea first come into play?
The idea started long ago. It was a seed that my dad planted, you know, when I got given opportunities in professional cricket, even young days. Mm. You know, he always laid this foundation of asking the question, well, how are you going to pay this back? And I never quite knew what that looked like or meant. So with that seed being planted, I was always on the lookout for opportunities to give back. Mm. And in 2015, we saw an opportunity where I'm from Mitchell's Plain in Strandfontein. And this is an area over a million people, so it's a big geographical sort of sphere in the Cape Flats, and you have 54 primary schools in this region. Hmm. And we did a sort of analysis where there was only 4 schools actually playing cricket.
Wow.
And this is only primary school, right? Hmm. So we then came in and looked at it from a perspective of, okay, so how do we revive the game of cricket, but then also use this as a vehicle to uplift the community, to change mindsets, to create some role models. You know, I think the seed was also planted that, you know, now young kids are looking to me as a role model. So how do I engage with them? What do I do with that credibility? Mm. Do I serve myself, or can I serve them? And I think that's the main ethos of the foundation, is really to use cricket as a vehicle to uplift the community. You think of not only this community, but many across the Cape Flats, mm. alcohol abuse, drug abuse, gangsterism. And, you know, often the next generation is looking for quick fixes, mm. all right? How do we, selling drugs or whatever the case may be. So changing their mindsets on what they see in front of them doesn't have to be the reality. Mm. And, you know, I have to be front and center with that. And that's, like I said, where the foundation was birthed. And to date now, we celebrated our 10-year anniversary end of last year, and we had a beautiful gala dinner where we raised some good funding. And just listening to the stories, man,
yeah.
that is the actual win. Mm. But also there's some sad stories there, you know, thinking about some of the kids getting caught in a gang crossfire. You know, one or two of the kids have actually died because of that. And, you know, it's sharing those stories with the people, because you're trying to help or sort of lay the foundation of what is actually happening in this community.
Yeah.
We're not all privy to that.
Yeah.
And to date now, what is it, 35 schools that we have in the league program, over 1,500 kids per week. So we run and facilitate the after school program now. We've got a mini cricket program, after schools program, bursary program, winter net program. And we, Mikael Prince, who's now got
Northwest.
Northwest, and has played South Africa A. He was 2015. He was in our program.
Wow.
So we've walked a journey with him in helping him with his bursary program and everything that is needed to give himself the best opportunity.
Man.
And it's just amazing to see now him making a success of it. And
he must come back to Cape Town, I think, in
a
couple of years' time. He's getting some good game time.
Yeah. And hopefully that's the case, right? Yeah. Where it comes back to where it all started.
Yeah.
But what's also what we love about this process is he's part of the foundation now in terms of telling his story.
Brilliant.
So they get an actual live story, some of the kids now, of somebody that has come out of this community, that has been part of our program,
absolutely,
but has made a success.
I mean, you can't ask for better than having that reference point.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, absolutely.
And do you feel, I mean, with your profile,
yeah.
I've seen you've done a lot of lobbying to the city of Cape Town, you know, government officials, etc. They listen when it comes from a high profile personality. I mean, so that's where your celebrity status does help, right? I mean, you need to leverage that.
It adds value for sure.
Yeah.
You know, it comes down to the classic reference of relationships matter.
Yeah.
But what I like to add to that, what is the integrity in that relationship?
Mm.
Is there sincerity in that relationship? Mm. So it's not just about what I can get. It's actually being invested in the people that you're engaging with.
Yeah.
So you talk about city officials and the corporate world, and it's hard work, man. Having to go and knock on people's doors and asking all the time, and still having the motivation when the door closes, unfortunately we don't have the means or whatever the case may be, you know, just continuing the journey. And the hope is that we've survived through COVID. You know, we've had some great partners on board and corporates on board and friends of and sponsors of the foundation, and we want to create a system where it's free flowing, you know, where there's not a lot of thinking that needs to happen. It just continues, and you know, it's a streamlined process of this machine just works. And yeah, I'm certainly motivated and encouraged by the fact that we will get there one day.
Are you more proud of that than you are of your actual playing career? I mean,
great question.
Is that your purpose?
Yeah. I think, you know, I don't want to take away the shine of one's career. I mean, I was blessed in many ways for the opportunities that I was presented. And, you know, I want to say this. People would often say, and I accept it, which I think there's a lot of truth in it. I probably didn't fulfill my potential as a cricketer. But what I see with that is it has created opportunities to provide opportunities for others. And that is to your point, purpose. And I think the word purpose really, it's what gets us up in the morning.
Yeah.
Right? Why do we do what we do? And for me, purpose often lies with others. And if I can hold on to that perspective, I believe that's gonna drive the motivation, the encouragement, no matter what happens. Hey, we keep moving. We keep moving. And, you know, it's not only the big moments. I think it's the small wins as well that we have to celebrate.
Yeah.
You know, particularly in the foundation, where just seeing kids smiling because they're excited about what's going to happen after school. Hey, that's a win, man. They could be going back to a home where there's no food. They don't have parents there. They're living with their grandparents. Can we really celebrate those wins and do it well?
And you look back on your career and you go, you were screaming and shouting in the change room because you got out stupidly or something. And then you look back and you're going, was it, you know, it's not so bad. There's a lot worse things going on.
I think perspective, the word you're referring to there is perspective is, in hindsight, it's always a great reference. You know, when you're in those moments of high voltage of anger or frustration, we don't necessarily want to throw our toys like that. But I think this is where integrity comes in. Can we acknowledge our faults? I think integrity is not about perfection. It is about awareness and understanding where we've come up short, own it. Okay, how do I do this better? And I think that's the perspective and learning that I've taken out of those frustrating moments is how can I just be better in this? How can I encourage somebody else to be better in this? That reference, we want to stay away from that and encourage them to be consistent in something else.
You're a very, you're a man of faith.
Sure.
And you put it out there and you are, and it's part of your DNA, your identity. Has that helped you transition from your playing days to coaching? And firstly, how difficult was that transition? Because
playing to coaching.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just quickly, the point of faith. I mean, it's been a pillar for me, particularly in the back half of my career. And you speak about this identity piece. It has reformed me in terms of understanding that my identity doesn't lie in performance. So that's the one part. The transition of playing to coaching or to whatever was next. It actually wasn't coaching first. It went straight into broadcasting.
Yeah.
It was hard, man. It really was hard. Mm. And the thing was, I knew what I was going into.
Yeah.
And I thought I prepared well, but it was so fascinating that when this part of your life was no more, it felt for a period of time there was this massive lull. And, you know, coming back to the faith part, it doesn't mean now that, you know, faith is such a great foundation for you that you don't go through speed bumps.
Mm.
I started questioning a whole lot of things, like who am I really?
Mm.
Because, you know, you had 20 years of this being part of your life. All of a sudden, it's gone.
Yeah.
And that transition was tough, you know, and it was hard to get through. But again, fortunately, the people around me helped me, encouraged me. My pastor from our church played such a pivotal part in that, you know, just we went for walks in the forest and just talked about things and how I felt and just encouraged and prayed for me. And that was a great journey. But again, with that, it allows for me to walk a journey with others that might go through something similar.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to only be about the transition of playing into whatever.
Mm.
It can be anything.
Mm.
And I can reference certain experiences that I've had. And that's not to tell them what to do. However, it's to share, hey, this was my experience.
Mm.
What you do with it, it's up to you. But I think the coaching part now has probably given me a little bit more stability and fulfillment in... I love broadcasting. I love coaching.
Mm.
And really, it's a great way of staying in the game as well.
Yeah.
Coaching is slightly different in that you're probably a little bit more emotionally invested, obviously, because you're with the team.
Mm.
Whereas broadcasting, you know, you're not necessarily emotionally invested in teams or the result of it.
Mm.
It's just making sure that you do your job well.
Mm.
And that's what I love about broadcasting. And we also get to mix with some really greats of the game in that that space. But coaching has certainly given me great fulfillment as well.
Coaching in different franchises around the world.
Yeah.
That's, you know, 1 week you're in Canada, then you're going to Pakistan Super League. Like, there's something that you as a coach have got your own philosophies and you've got your own mantra, etc.
Yeah.
Do you waver on that according to the team that you're coaching when it's completely different cultures? I mean,
sure.
Or do you stick to who JB Dumini is as the coach?
This was an interesting learning for me, I would say. I probably went into the franchise world with that understanding. This is who I am. This is how I want to do things. And I'm going to try and stick with that.
Mm.
But I quickly learned is that there has to be there's a framework. I'd say that's probably the best way to put it.
Yeah.
But the ability to chop and change certain things, listen a little bit more, ask questions, understand. As an example, coaching in an SA20 as an example, rather than coaching in a T10 competition, totally different.
Yeah,
I mean, I did a Zim T10 a couple of years ago. It's basically a party.
Yeah,
you know, you don't. I think we trained once. We don't really have much team meetings. There's not analysis going on or anything like that. You just come and you rock up and you play.
Mm.
SA20, different.
Mm.
A lot more in terms of depth of preparation. You have a lot more practice days and. So adjusting to that mentality and also understanding, this is a great phrase that I've learned from other coaches, meet players where they are.
Nice. Yeah.
So what that means is if I'm going to be dealing with a player that's 35 that has played international cricket compared to a player that's 24, that's maybe on the brink of making international cricket. That's a difference there, right? I don't need to engage with the 35-year-old than the 24. Yes, there's some team concepts or tactical things that we're going to converse about, but it's really about the relational equities that are important. You know, players, they want to know that you care about them before they're actually you caring about their performance.
Mm.
Take an interest in them.
Yeah.
And I would say that's probably the grounding principle that I try and operate on.
Mm.
As who is the player?
Mm.
Oh, sorry, who is the person? And then we'll tap into the player as well.
Mm.
And I've had to learn the hard way. You know, you there's breakdown in the relationships because you feel like, no, but we have to do it this way.
Mm.
I'm also young in my coaching career. compared to, let's say, Andy Flower, who's coached international cricket for many years, has been around for many, many more years. Mm. His pedigree is different. Mm. His style might be different, but also he understands different things. And I'm still on the journey of learning, 100%. So, yeah, there's been some great moments of learning that hopefully will aid me well going forward.
How do you as a coach, because you've been there as a youngster coming through, you play fearless cricket, you know, coming through, you may be a little bit arrogant and you're confident, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. There's a lot of young cricketers that play a lot of these leagues that haven't played a lot of international cricket, but they're earning a bucket load of money. And is there an element with some of these youngsters, they come into a team environment saying, I'm the shit, basically. And how do you quell that? And how do you get back to the principles of cricket?
So I think it's an interesting one where, so what tournament are we dealing with here is probably the first question.
Mm.
As I said earlier, an SA20 to a T10 is going to be different.
Yeah.
You have literally 2 weeks,
mm.
if that, with a T10 competition.
Yeah.
So for me now, trying to chop down a player that's maybe has a little bit too much arrogance might not be beneficial to his performance.
Yeah.
So trying to meet him where he is.
Mm.
Okay, so now we're going to talk more tactics around certain players that we're coming up against. This is take him on here, take him on. I'm actually not trying to talk him out of that. I'm trying to enhance it.
Yeah.
Because now we're talking into performance. Whereas if it's an IPL, you're spending 2.5 months together.
Yeah.
You walk a journey with somebody.
Mm.
Yes, there's an element of performance, but here's an opportunity to really build a strong relationship.
Yeah. You feel that your coaching style is suited to those kind of longer tournaments where you can build a rapport and a relationship with
them? I would say that, yeah, that's probably a great assessment. Mm. That probably suits me as a person and as a coach.
Mm.
But I've had to learn to adjust because opportunities are not only going to be in there, right? And I think it stretches me in terms of my coaching.
Yeah.
So that's what I love about it. And, yeah, it just comes down to this basic principle for me is, like, meet them where they're at.
Mm.
And use the people in the room.
Mm.
Right. So what does that mean? Okay. So if I got a relationship with an ex player from England,
mm.
but here's another young player from England that I don't know,
mm.
have a conversation with them first. Hey, what is your take on him?
Mm.
What gets the best out of him? How do I approach him?
Mm.
What is your relationship with? You can even go through him, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't have to have a detailed conversation with him. So those kind of things. Using your support staff.
Mm.
You know, maybe my assistant has a relationship with that guy already. Have a conversation with him. Hey, maybe you should have a conversation. These are the things that I'm wanting to understand better. Maybe try and get that out of him. Let's see how we can do it.
Do you get to choose your assistant coaches in some of these leagues, or are you just, you're there and all of a sudden there's a former England player who's...
Not always. And that's also been interesting at times.
Yeah.
But also, I think what has that allowed for me is that it gives you an opportunity to stretch as a coach because now you have to put yourself out there, build relationships, even with your support staff. I think everybody would jump at the first opportunity to bring some people in. Mm. But certain leagues doesn't provide that. I mean, I'm going to a T10 tournament in Dallas in October.
Yeah, I saw that.
And essentially, I'm one of the coaches, head coaches, as an international, and I'm not allowed to bring anyone in. And your support staff was all going to be local guys.
Okay.
So you get a pick from a pool of local people that I know.
No idea
who they are. And again, it stretches you as a person, right?
Yeah.
So, like, who are you authentically to present to them? Mm. Can I communicate with them well enough to be able to extract from what I need, what I want, and sort of create a measuring tool around that, I guess. But yeah, you don't always get what you want.
Was there ever a point in when you first started your coaching career, a bit of imposter syndrome? Like, you knew you had the pedigree as a player, but when you walked into that first change room and all of a sudden you weren't in the corner listening to the coach, you were the guy that had to give the talk.
100%. I think it still lives there.
Mm.
So, you know, the great sort of understanding that courage is not the absence of fear.
Mm.
It's actually understanding and accepting that it's there and then doing it anyway, right? So even though I would say it's not maybe as heightened anymore, there's still question marks in your mind about, hey, what do they think about me? Am I doing this well enough? And I have to remind myself that all I can present is my best version.
Mm.
And there's a guarantee that not everyone is going to respond well to it.
Yeah.
Some are going to look at it, ah, this is not for me. Or no, is this or is that? It's just part of the game, right? Mm. And all I can present is the authenticity around who I am, being open to learn, being open to listen, open to understanding of how to do things differently, except when there's failure.
Mm.
Except when I've not particularly owned it.
Mm.
Own when, hey, I didn't do that well, guys. And I'm open to listening to guys around, hey, how can I do it better? Yeah.
Take me to just the SA20 auctions coming up in September. I've always been fascinated around those team meetings the night before. Mm. And you're all sitting there with laptops, and then there's one guy that's normally got glasses on, and he's the analysis.
Yeah.
And somehow he's got a program that he works off that can spew out any single scenario that you... What are some of the things that you as a coach and your management team and your owners, you go into that room and you're looking for?
Well, I think the starting point is style of play. What are we looking for?
Mm.
How do we want to stack up, let's call it power play, middle, back end, right? Bowling and batting. But I think also what comes into the mix is character.
Mm.
Now, you've got to determine what's the most important part for you. So some coaches will say, look, I'm not going to waver on character.
Mm.
Character is one of the most critical pieces for me. So he needs to be good team man. And what are the criteria for that? Some might say, hey, I don't mind a maverick, you know, but he's got ample amount of talent and ability that can win you games. I'll deal with the character.
Mm.
So I think everybody comes in with something different. But I think those three things are critical. And then there's the analysis around that, right? So when I talk about style of play, how can we best impact the game in power play, middle, and back end? Something that was interesting around a research tool when I was with Paul Royals, the stat was that David Miller is the best finisher in the last 10 overs. So he produces the best results from a runs and an average point of view and a strike rate point of view in the last 10 overs in world cricket.
Wow.
So now what you're trying to do, you're trying to stack up your team that allows for him to be in that position more often than not.
Gotcha.
So how can we stack up our team that allows for him to come in after 10 overs?
Mm.
And that was the strategy, right?
Yeah.
And you know, there are many sort of metrics around various strategies around teams. But I think the analytics plays such a pivotal role now in that process leading to the auction.
Yeah. You can overanalyze as well, right?
100%.
Yeah.
But I think at times where the over analytics happen is maybe pre-game or during game.
Yeah.
But I think the analytics, well, this is just my opinion on it. I think analytics are primed for auctions because now you get to really see combinations.
Mm.
Okay, so his strike rate is X. He's very good in the power play with the new ball.
Mm.
Okay, how do we stack this up and try and mix and match that way?
Is there a time where you've been hellbent on a certain player because he fits a certain role,
sure,
but wasn't a big name?
Yeah.
Has there ever been? I remember, I think in season two with Sunrise at Eastern Cape, and they signed Daniel Worrell.
Okay.
And I looked at that, and I'm like, shit, that's a gun signing.
Sure.
Because he wasn't a massive name. He wasn't playing international cricket, but for that particular role that Adi Burrell needed, it was a gun signing, and he was one of their top bowlers.
Sure.
Has there been a time where you've picked a player and you go, I don't care what anybody thinks, this oak is going to do the job for me?
I mean, he's played for South Africa a good few times, but I think somebody that comes to mind that sort of fits that role would be Bjorn Fortuin.
Mm.
You know, in that first season,
especially in Paul.
Yeah,
yeah.
So it was, you know, I remember even seeing this past season where they bowled 20 overs with
him. Yeah.
But we knew that he had great results in analytics with the new ball in the power play, but it just suited the conditions so well.
Yeah.
So he was somebody that we wanted to make sure that we got, and that worked out beautifully.
It worked out really well. I love the fact that it's not been about, and it epitomizes who you are. You're not defined by cricket. Cricket has given you a playing career that is, I mean, you think about it, a playing career lasts, or maybe if you're lucky, 35, 36.
Yeah.
Not everyone plays until they're 40.
Except for Imran Tahir.
Except Imran Tahir, who actually, I saw a crazy stat. He's got 260 wickets or something since he turned 40. I mean, that's just ridiculous.
During this,
diverting a little bit, but I laughed when Imran Tahir was the impact player.
Oh, yeah.
When in your tournament now, and he was the oldest one in the team, basically. But you guys were all hamstringed out, and some might say your biggest signing wasn't AB de Villiers, it was Shane Jabbar, the physio. We're getting to the stage of a couple of sections here.
Okay.
We've got a section called The Roast. We are sitting at our regular venue here.
Mm-hmm.
We like to ask the guys, you know, what is the best roast or the best chirp that you've ever either delivered or you heard on the field that you got there and you went, okay, that's a good one. As a batter, you maybe go, okay, you got me. I'm prepared to, like, lower my guard, yeah.
Well, what's the rating here? Is it?
It's open. There's zero rating. Whatever YouTube.
What's the age group here? I mean, I guess there was some kind of roast to it when he got into the change room, and it's just a famous story of Morne Mokgo, the Oval 2008 Test match, and Graham was the captain at the time, and. Yeah, we were sort of survival mode in some ways. Flintoff was bowling speed of light, and unfortunately, Morne got out. And he says he remembered that if you get out, you don't come back to the change room. But anyway, he was so disappointed, Morne was, when he got out. He didn't look where he was walking when he was walking off. And he had like his head down, and he was walking what he thought at the time was towards the change room. And it was probably about 50 meters to the right. And eventually when he looked up, he...
the ground staff.
Yeah, exactly. The ground staff den. And it would have... Like, the crowd is obviously watching this person. And it was too embarrassing for him to actually... Because he got to the steps. And it was too embarrassing for him to walk down. And he ended up walking in the crowd. He ended up walking across the crowd to the stairs where we walked up to the change room.
Yeah.
And I mean, through all the disappointment of what had happened in that moment of the game, we were killing ourselves with laughter in the change room. And obviously got roasted quite nicely in the change room.
I love that. I love that story. Yeah. In the final section, which this episode, we've actually got a partner. It's Fields. It's a clothing brand company. We've got a little gift for you for coming onto the show from our partners. It's sponsored by them this week. It's the declaration. It's a little quick fire questions.
Sure.
You don't have to give yes or no answer, just shoot. First one, most underrated cricketer you've ever played it with?
Played with Bjorn Fortuin.
Nice. The funniest thing you've ever seen on the field of play? On the field.
I was actually part of it. Myself and KJ Rabada ran into each other. So I went up for the catch. I caught the ball. He rugby tackled, landed literally, he shouldered me into my gut. And we both, it was like he took me down of a high ball in rugby.
I remember
that. Fortunately, I held on to the ball, but the crowd lost their minds. Yeah.
And thankfully, you both went.
Yeah, we were fine.
Yeah. Can't imagine being tackled by KJ.
That was pleasant.
To be fair. One thing you wish people knew about you that has nothing to do with cricket.
That I wish they knew.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't say I wish they knew, but what I can share, I've got a special blanket.
Got a special blanket?
That I sleep with at night.
Love it, love it, love it.
It goes in between my fingers as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Amazing. Worst roommate of all time?
Oh, Monde Zondeki.
That was a very quick, I didn't even
finish. Monde Zondeki was the worst.
Why?
Snorer, feet stank. Fortunately, we had two separate beds.
Yeah.
But just like, it was just untidy all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
One teammate you'd pick to bat for your life?
Hashim Amla.
Great call.
Mm.
He's a banker. Okay, final question. What is JP Duminy doing in 5 years' time?
Ooh. Needs a neck crack.
In 5 minutes' time, he needs a neck crack.
What am I going to be doing in 5 years' time? My hope and wish would be that the foundation is so established and just working like this oiled machine where my role within the foundation is really just to motivate and encourage the kids that we work with, uplift them, and provide opportunities that would launch them to really make a success of themselves.
Mm. Love that. One final question, actually. It's a seventh question. It's a noble of the final delivery. Is that sitting opposite you right now is me, but if six-year-old JP Duminy was sitting in front of you right now,
all right,
what would you want to say to him?
Mm. That no matter what life throws at you, it's not the end. So I think the great phrase that I've learnt and observed in recent times, in the end, it's all going to be okay. And if it's not, it's not the end.
Love it. Perfect way to end.
Yeah, love that.
Ladies and gents, that was JP Duminy, and I'm the biggest man in cricket. Thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.